variety of coloured squares, a montage of archive footage reflects different aspects of British life, from coastal towns to fun fairs, children playing on a street, a hovercraft, George Best and Twiggy. BBC Time Shift. James Bond turning to point his gun.
Ever since a British secret agent named Bond, James Bond, embarked on his first mission, a large global corporation has been keeping tabs on his every move.
On set, Miss Connery.
There's such a lot of Bond to see, isn't there? Is there no end?
Now, after more than 60 years of tracking 007 in print and on screen, we open up the BBC vaults to reveal the forgotten files on the world's most celebrated secret agent.
The world's most famous hero assumes a natural position.
He's tall and he's dark.
Through candid interrogations.
How much of that action do you enjoy?
I enjoy all of it. Particularly the love scenes.
Roger Moore filming a kiss.
Technical briefings.
But this slides away to let the missile come out of the volcano.
And foreign assignments, we assess Bond's ability to survive in a changing world.
The Bond movies generally are simply a license to print money.
His transgressions, his victories, and his innermost secrets explored.
This is the sort of question that you should not be asking.
This is A License to View, James Bond. Unguarded, unrestricted, and unseen.
Looking for Mr. Bond, 007 at the BBC. Time Out, 1964.
In 1964, the BBC filed a report from the United States Gold Bullion Depository at Fort Knox. And their man on the ground bore more than a passing resemblance to the spy himself.
Incidentally, that's not Fort Knox. It's a film set here, Goldfinger, in Buckinghamshire, Pinewood. I'm not James Bond. He's a fictitious character.
Sean Connery had taken a break from filming Goldfinger to reveal for the BBC, for the very first time, the true identity of Bond's armourer, Q.
My name's Boothroyd, Geoffrey Boothroyd. Certain inaccuracies in the book made me write to Fleming and say that I didn't think Bond was going to last very long if he used a 2.5 Beretta pistol, which is a lady's gun and not a very nice lady at that.
Now, this is the gun Boothroyd objected to, Bond's favourite Beretta. Bond was using the shoulder holster at the time. But his favourite holster was chamois leather, because, you see, it didn't spoil the line of the jacket. I take you over now to a film clip you see here where Major Boothroyd is convincing 007, in the company of M, of Fleming's mistake.
From now on, you carry a different gun. Show him, Armourer.
Valter PPK, 7.65 mil with a delivery like a brick through a plate glass window. Takes a Brausch silencer with very little reduction in muzzle velocity. The American CIA swear by them.
Thank you, Major Boothroyd.
An old photo of Boothroyd and Ian Fleming.
Having exposed Q's real identity, the BBC sought to uncover the model for Bond himself, but his creator proved evasive.
People do connect me with James Bond simply because I happen to like some of the things that James Bond does. But he's the sort of mixture of commandos and Secret Service agents that I met during the war. But, of course, entirely fictionalized. So I certainly haven't got his guts nor his very lively appetite.
However, his close friend and neighbour in Jamaica was far less guarded.
I think that James Bond was Ian's dream fantasy of what he would like to be, you know, ruthless and dashing, and it's got, as Ian had, a schoolboy quality.
Noel Coward in 69.
And further revelations came from a certain flirtatious secretary.
The first meeting with Ian was at a reception after we'd finished From Russia with Love, and suddenly he said, Moneypenny. I want to thank you, because when I first wrote about Miss Moneypenny, I described her as a tall, elegant woman with the most unkissable lips in the world. And he said, you are so perfect. And he was coming closer and closer to me, much to my delight. And when he was about this far away, I said, what do you want me to say, prunes or cheese? And he said, prunes. And just as he was about to kiss me, his wife said, oh, Ian, Bedford wants to speak to you.
Lois Maxwell, Miss Moneypenny.
Moneypenny may have been smitten, but there were those who did not warm to Fleming at all, as BBC viewers found out when Malcolm Muggeridge quizzed a former MI6 agent turned spy novelist.
I'm not sure that Bond is a spy. Seems to me that he's more some kind of international gangster with, as is said, a license to kill. He's a man with unlimited movement, but he's a man entirely out of the political context. It's of no interest to Bond, who, for instance, is President of the United States.
John le Carré.
But these highfalutin intellectuals had failed to notice that it was actually the President himself who had brought Bond to the world's attention. In an article for Life magazine in March 1961, John F. Kennedy had included From Russia with Love in a list of his 10 favourite books, and this was just the break that two movie moguls needed. American Cubby Broccoli and Canadian Harry Saltzman had already bought the options on Fleming's novels, and with paperback sales rocketing after Kennedy's endorsement, they flew to New York to secure the deal with United Artists that would put James Bond on screen.
Normally, the question from the distributor is, who is going to play in it, Cary Grant or James Mason or someone? And when you surprise them by telling them you don't want a known name in there, you want an unknown, he's further confused and it's a little more difficult to get the financing.
Cubby Broccoli.
But under pressure to cast a leading man, the producers stood their ground for a little-known Scottish actor called Sean Connery, who they believed best displayed the degree of masculine virility that Bond demanded.
Cubby and I went through, I would say, 200 actors. I liked the way he moved, and the fact that he had a lot of acting experience. But he moves extremely well. There's only one other actor who moves as well as he is, Albert Finney. They move like cats. They're very light. For a big man to be light on his feet, it's most unusual.
Harry Saltzman.
However, Fleming remained equivocal, thinking Connery to be an overdeveloped stuntman without the social graces to play his hero. But his opinion was swayed when female friends of his pronounced Connery as most definitely having it.
I met Fleming two or three times and got on very, very well. I liked him enormously.
He had such curiosity and his knowledge was so wide. Terrible snob, but terrific companion. But I think in the main, he wanted somebody unknown so that they would not overshadow the character of James Bond.
To the British public, James Bond perfectly caught the mood of the times and brought a sense of reassurance to a country in the grip of Cold War spy mania.
If there was a third man, were you in fact the third man?
No, I was not.
Well, he's a free agent, as I said, at the present time, to go as he pleases.
Dr. No, released on the same day as the Beatles' first single, introduced a new emblem for a modern Britain. And when Bond's silhouette, or rather that of stuntman Bob Simmons, came sauntering across cinema screens, audiences broke into spontaneous applause. It was with Goldfinger, the third film in the series, that the producers served up their winning cocktail. And the pre-title sequence is a stimulating aperitif of its own with all the Bond ingredients. Beginning with a typically witty gadget, the sequence combined sleek interior sets, stylish posturing, flagrant seduction of a dispensable femme fatale, and graphic violence, all culminating in a perfectly delivered throwaway line.
Positively shocking.
And a door slam to cue a knockout song.
The opening titles to Goldfinger, with a golden hand rising up the screen, and the words Albert R. Broccoli and Harry Saltzman present.
Goldfinger!
Shirley Bassey, live in 1974.
As both an establishment figure and icon of pop culture, James Bond was an easy target during what was the satire boom of the early 1960s.
The Dick Emery Show, 1964.
Shirley Bassey doesn't think much of you for a start. I mean, she says you've got a cold finger, Goldfinger. How she ever found that out, I don't know, but that's her business.
Casino Royale, Diamonds Are Forever, From Russia With Sex.
That was the week that was in 1963. Then Scott on Birds in 1964, and Terry Scott fumbling with a gun.
For Your Thighs Only, Doctor in the Know, Carry On Spy, Moonfinger and Muckraker.
Scott checks his watch.
Oh, well, there goes Cuba.
There's such a lot of Bond to see, isn't there? Is there no end? We're proud to present tonight Bye Bye Bondy, the latest, indeed one might almost say the last episode, in 007.
It was a black letter day for Bond. He received the summons and lost no time in getting to the office of M, his chief. When Bond entered, M was inscrutable as always.
David Frost's co-host, Double M, Millicent Martin, would spoof Bond on her own show. And her choice of guest star would prove prophetic.
Perhaps Monsieur would like to take drinks on Sir Pet, you?
Yes.
That's quite a nice little casino you've got.
It was almost as if he was auditioning for the part, a decade early.
A nice secluded corner.
Over there, Mr. Bond.
Yes, well, I am on holiday. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Smith.
Roger Moore on her show in
1964. Oh, oh.
Yes, and I'm 007, as if you didn't know.
James Bond, what are you doing at my hotel?
And what may I ask, is Sonia Slukova, Russia's master spy, doing staying at my hotel?
Black and white footage of Sean Connery being filmed as Bond.
By 1965, nothing, it seemed, could match Bond. Not even the Beatles. The soundtrack to Goldfinger outsold the Mop Tops. And during the filming of Thunderball in the Bahamas, Bond mania reached new heights, or rather, further depths. A press release given to the BBC on location described the hysteria around Connery. When a group of American students swam out to his filming boat. "Speak to us," one of them called to him. "You are our leader and we are your people."
Sean Connery as Bond on the cover of Esquire magazine.
The globe-trotting spy was now a trend-setting brand, whose personality and paraphernalia saturated public life.
The Bond films set a complete style and had a tremendous influence on design and throughout the whole range of the visual arts. Did it come as a surprise to you that, in fact, the population took up many of the sort of Bond images and carried them into
life? We never expected that tremendous success, but after the first, we saw there was a market. The second, we very carefully accentuated the successful parts.
Bond's iconic car from Goldfinger, the Aston Martin DB5, proved a gift for merchandisers. And Corgi's miniature version would go on to sell in its millions.
Whoops, hello there. Now, this is the star of the show, I think, because this is the model of the car that was made for James Bond in Goldfinger. You press that knob there, out come the two overriders and the machine guns. Now, you've got somebody sitting next to you in the car and you don't like him, just watch the roof. Whee, out he comes. There goes Oddjob.
Now every child could have their very own Bond gadget. Or if you had the clout, you could just pop along to the factory and pick up a scale model for your son. But some BBC pundits were worried that Bond, as a commodity, was just a smokescreen for a character with very little depth.
There's no mystery about James Bond. It's too easy, you see, with all this imitation equipment. The man himself is nothing. With due respect, Mr. Connery.
Personally, I have never been able to collapse in the arms of Mr. Bond. I see a sort of new hero emerging now.
And the new one on the way is the transvestite, like Danny LaRue, like a splendid hero.
Patrick Campbell talking to S.J. Perelman.
As production began on the next Bond bonanza, and amidst rumours that Connery was getting itchy feet in the role, the BBC undertook a more probing investigation into the current state of 007. And for such a special assignment, they sent in their top man.
Wicker's World.
Japan Pinewood style, and the first day's shooting on the fifth film in the cinema's most spectacular saga. They're spending £3 million on You Only Live Twice, but it'll probably earn 10 times that around the world.
To write the script, which involved an entirely different plot to the book, the producers had drafted in an old charm of Ian Fleming's. But for the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, writing a Bond film would be a very different confection.
Did you have a certain number of things that you had to do? For example, Bond normally goes through women in a film, doesn't he?
Now, what do you mean by going through them?
Well, he disposes of them. They get killed, they sacrifice themselves, you know. Are you,
yes.
Are you up to ration?
There's no question that you must stick to that sort of formula, I think, because I asked that when I went in first. They said, oh, yes. I said, he wants a woman, doesn't he, to chase around and fall in love with. And they said, well, three would be better.
Wicker was on hand to watch the pre-title sequence being shot.
Better, huh?
No, just different. Like Peking duck is different from Kasha.
A clever tease in which Dahl flipped Bond's weakness for women into his undoing.
Darling, I give you very best duck.
Well, that'd be lovely. We have had some interesting times together, Ling. I'd be sorry to go.
Ling pushes a button to flip Bond's bed up into the wall, then lets in two gunmen who fire at it.
Stop, cut it, hold everything!
So James Bond's been shot where it hurts most, in bed.
As Wicker slipped deeper under the covers...
Test three, take one.
You are a slippery customer, aren't you?
He turned his beady eye onto a bevy of girls submitting themselves to the casting session.
Bond's birds seldom last more than 10 minutes before something frightful happens to them. But during their brief, passionate posturing, they brave piranhas and death rays for the pleasure of sharing his bedroom and his vodka martinis.
What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?
You're a handsome-looking brute.
Eager to surrender their cinematic all, they're screen-tested. They're still not exposed to the real James Bond. They have to make love to his substitute.
And to better understand the Bond girl vetting process, Wicker sounded out the film's director, Lewis Gilbert.
Well, you know, there's a sort of classic tradition of Bond girls, but this one is a German or Swedish girl.
Yeah.
But obviously she must be pretty glamorous. But we are trying to do something different with a Bond girl. This time we'd like to try and find somebody who can act.
So what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?
She leans in to kiss him.
Is it a bit too disfiguring when she goes very hard in?
Yeah.
Yeah, after the kiss, let him have his main speech.
Mm-hmm.
But as Wicker found out when he followed the production to Japan... Wherever in the world Bond went, there was an expectation to conform to his values.
The armor pearl-diving girls went on strike, frightened of overexposure. They're actually starlets and models. There's even a lift girl from the Tokyo Hilton. But East is East, and none of these big-city pearl-divers wanted to be photographed in a bikini. They resisted the American public relations man who was after some Japanese cheesecake.
Mike, let me explain what I'm
trying to do. I understand
you
what you want.
You don't understand what... I want to get all of them lined up
Right.
In modern bathing costumes.
Right, and they don't want to take off their
sink, yes. No.
They don't want to.
I don't care what they want.
What's the trouble, Gabby? What is in fact happening?
Oh, it's not really serious. We have eight armor girls, or girls who are supposed to be armor girls. They're Japanese types. The production department is having a difficult time getting them to remove not their brassieres or anything, just their outer garment. They feel that they're not accustomed to walking around in bikinis.
Not until Broccoli got there, they weren't.
The girls in their bikinis.
But there was further trouble in paradise, and Wicker's cameras were there to capture the Bond wagon slowly coming off the rails.
Now, he's an actor. He's here to do a job. He's not just a publicity idol for them. Now, he's here, and he has not been given the privilege and respect of Japan for a certain amount of privacy.
Connery felt he was no longer a human being, but a public institution, and not so much an actor as a commodity. With fears of becoming typecast, of being overshadowed by gadgets and a gargantuan man-made volcano, Connery thought it was time to hang up his holster.
I'm very tired because I've been, it's a long uphill grind. I've had a long sort of innings, as it were, and a very intense innings, and I want to change direction now, take another breath and do something else.
So this is your last Bond film?
Yes.
With Sean Connery's departure, the Bond franchise faced its first crisis. Connery had owned the part completely, and a replacement seemed unthinkable, although Cubby Broccoli remained optimistic.
This won't stop us from making another Bond, because an audience out there want to see it. We present what we have for their approval.
You'd have a headache breaking in a new Bond, actually, wouldn't you, after five?
Everything is a headache.
In early 1968, the hunt was on for an actor to fill Connery's shoes, when a 29-year-old Australian model and used car salesman called George Lazenby suddenly swaggered into Broccoli and Saltzman's office.
I was standing there in a Connery suit, a Connery haircut, Rolex watch, crossed arms, saying, "I heard you're looking for James Bond."
Broccoli had deep reservations about hiring a clothes peg, as he referred to Lazenby. So, over 4 months, they tested him against the rest of the cast, until finally Harry Saltzman said he wanted to see Lazenby in a fight scene.
They got this big Russian guy. Well, I knocked him on his butt because I didn't know how to miss. And I thought, oh my God, when this guy gets up, he's going to kill me. He's a real Russian wrestler, you know. But he was okay. And Harry stepped over him and says, "We're going with you."
George Lazenby on Famous for 15 Minutes in 1997.
Aside from the small matter of finding a new Bond, on Her Majesty's Secret Service would see him get hitched. And in choosing an actress of Diana Rigg's caliber, the producers hoped to increase the power of the film's romantic scenes. The BBC caught up with Rigg on location in Portugal to ask her what she felt the issues were for women in Bond's world.
From the woman's point of view, mainly the fact that the women are victims. And in our society at the moment, women are being very busy trying to prove that they aren't victims. But Ian Fleming definitely puts them in sort of subsidiary position. And Bond uses them. They are vessels either for his lust or to get to the big bad boss or something. You know, they're ciphers. They're not real people.
Alongside Rigg, these ciphers come in the form of a deadly harem under the control of the arch-villain Blofeld. But in this story, Fleming at last allows Bond to fall in love.
In a sense, it's a game, but also it's quite a clever trick, because the man who heretofore has been absolutely unobtainable suddenly decides, through love or whatever, to marry this girl, and he subscribes. But Ian Fleming only allows him to subscribe for an hour after his wedding, and then I get a bullet through one ear and out the other.
Diana Rigg speaking in 1969.
It's Blofeld.
Bond's wife has been shot dead.
You know, it's quite a good trick because it means that he has all the right motives deep down underneath. In other words, he is prepared to get married if he loves the girl, but then by some terrible trick of fate, she's taken away from him and he's suddenly available for all those females again, slightly embittered, you know.
But becoming Bond was to leave Lazenby embittered too. Reports had circulated that he was awkward and arrogant on set, overwhelmed by the responsibility of the role.
The critics, rather brutally, pounded him with such comments as, his lines carry about as much conviction as an insecticide salesman at a flea circus. But in spite of the critics, Mr. Lazenby appears to know his own mind and has maintained a stubborn sense of individuality. He grew a beard, for instance, and refused to shave it off for the film premiere.
And I said, well, anyone can understand that James Bond isn't a real person, and they're not going to mind the fact that I haven't had a shave for a month. You know, everyone knows that James Bond must have a beard, even though you never see it in the film.
Well, what about the reports that you were deliberately awkward and hostile?
Yeah, well, they were true in a way because I was very uptight lots of the times because I didn't understand exactly what was going on. And the only person you could ask, the only person who knew what was going on was the director. And he didn't really feel that an actor was important in the role. He felt that you could get any guy, I'd put him in that part and make him James Bond, providing he looked similar to what the public feel James Bond looks like. And this came, that vibration came off the director onto me all the time.
Speaking on Nationwide in 1970,
Lazenby had begun to feel that Bond wasn't quite as far out as he could be in 1969. This was now the era of peace, not war, he thought.
Well, how about the director? Did he agree with your idea of Bond?
Well, no, they had a set formula, which was a winner previous, and you can't blame them for not agreeing with me, because I was a learner. I felt quite confident that if they did change it, you know, like putting pop music behind it and rather than the sort of light music they have, and things like that, it would have lifted the whole thing up again into another decade, 1970.
Lazenby, feeling that Bond had no place in the emerging counterculture, kept the beard and hit the road.
He rides off on a motorbike. Now film of a golden car speeding onto set.
With Lazenby gone, a plan was hatched to lure back Sean Connery, who was only too aware of the strong bargaining position he now found himself in, as he candidly let slip to the BBC.
Having been away for 4 years, I think one had made the point too with the lack of success of the one previous, the one that I wasn't in anyway. And coming back in to do this one, the wicket was better for me to make the conditions of not being so much a pawn in the circumstances. Also, I didn't think I got a fair piece of the cake.
You mean financially?
Yes.
Connery had been tempted back not only with the promise of a tremendous fee, but also by the quality of the script, drafted by a young American screenwriter called Tom Mankiewicz.
I hope that Guy Hamilton, the director, and myself, and with the assistance of Tom Mankiewicz, who's written the screenplay, which incidentally I think is probably the best one they've had, certainly construction-wise, for a beginning, a middle, and an end of a story. It's very good. It's a very good script. I hope it's got enough... I think that there's humour in it.
And for this moment in a Las Vegas casino, Connery and Mankiewicz shared the writing honours.
Hi, I'm Plenty.
But of course you are.
Plenty O'Toole.
Named after your father, perhaps?
Would you like some help? On the craps, I mean.
It's very kind of you.
The camp and breezy tone of Diamonds Are Forever, with its liberal use of smutty humour, was a new throw of the dice for the Bond franchise.
Nine, mark nine.
Nimmo in Las Vegas, 1972.
To see if this gamble was paying off, the BBC dispatched one of its top entertainers to Sin City. Derek Nimmo arrived just as Connery was shooting his first scenes.
He speeds through neon-lit streets in a red sports car.
A frenetic car chase on the downtown strip, involving real pedestrians. And you couldn't get much closer to the action than Nimmo did, as he almost found out to his peril.
The red car speeds up to Nimmo.
What the hell are you doing?
Well, what are you doing here?
Derek Nimmo.
I'm terribly sorry. Yes, what are you doing? Well, why are you driving on the pavement?
Well, I'm making diamonds up for Evan. It's a film.
Well, film? Oh, I see, you're not in trouble then. Matter of fact, I rather am in trouble. You see, I was here for the gambling, and I've won quite a lot, really, but I'm down now to about $1,700. I don't quite know what to do, really.
Well, if I were you, I'd get the hell out of it.
Connery's swift exit after Diamonds Are Forever would cause the producers to begin their hunt for what would be the third different Bond in less than 4 years. But many, including Connery, were feeling the series may have run its course.
I came back for the one, that was the understanding, and I'd do the one, and I've got other things I want to do. I mean, it's perfectly possible that the cycle has ended.
But far from ending the cycle, it was Mankiewicz's sparkling one-liners and Connery's tongue-in-cheek approach that would set the tone for the coming films.
Sean Connery was the first screen Bond, but now that he no longer plays the role, United Artists have laid him to rest. Sean who, they say? No, there's only one James Bond, and that's Roger Moore, who, of course, just happens to be the latest.
Lowering his gun and raising his eyebrow, Roger Moore seemed to continue from where he'd left off on the Millicent Martin show back in 1964.
Black Queen on the Red King, Miss...
Solitaire.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
I know who you are, what you are, and why you have come. You have made a mistake. You will not succeed.
Did Solitaire know something we didn't? Moore determined to play the role for laughs. But there were concerns as to whether he could really cut it as James Bond.
When you took over from Sean Connery, because it was new and because it was different, people all said, oh, well, Roger Moore is not my idea of 007. And he's not like Sean Connery, and it's all a great failure. I mean, do you mind that kind of hammering?
No, not really, because I say it before they do. I think the first time they went to see Live and Let Die was just to see if I was going to be as bad as they thought I would be.
Speaking on Nationwide in 1973.
With the uncertainty of a new Bond, the producers had felt panicked into chasing current cinema trends. But James Bond sat uncomfortably in both a blaxploitation milieu and a kung fu craze.
Stand back, girls.
In 1975, Harry Saltzman, beset by financial difficulties, was forced to sell his share in the Bond franchise to United Artists. The breakup of his winning partnership with Cubby Broccoli, together with the lukewarm reception for The Man with the Golden Gun, couldn't have come at a worse time. By the mid-1970s, film production in Britain was in harsh decline. But undeterred, Broccoli resolved to go for broke with his next venture, The Spy Who Loved Me, determined that Bond would keep the British end up.
Obviously, we do make the picture for a worldwide market, and I think that's the hope of the British industry. We feel we have to do something more outrageous, more bizarre, and more unique.
For Broccoli and the Bond franchise, this would be a very symbolic leap of faith.
Bond skis off a mountainside, then starts to plummet.
The film's audacious opening stunt was filmed from multiple angles, but they went with a single shot, and the whole world held its breath.
He pulls the ripcord, and a Union Jack parachute billows out above him.
Such was the confidence in The Spy Who Loved Me and the feeling that it might just prove the saviour of the British film industry that the BBC, in collaboration with the Open University, secured unique access to the film's production as the basis for a course unpromisingly entitled Mass Communications and Society.
More as Bond fires a gun.
My name is Bond. James Bond.
The resulting 8-part series examined all aspects of Bondiana, from giving Bond a new soundtrack for the 1970s.
I was very anxious to write a song that I thought was completely different than any of the songs that had been written for the Bond films. And I also didn't want them to quite be about the villain. I wanted a song written about Bond. I thought it was time that he be pretentious enough and vain enough, in fact, to have a song written about him.
To the usual pressures of being a Bond girl.
The one thing that sometimes I don't particularly like is the, let's say, the sex symbol part of it, as most of the Bond girls have been, because that is not at all my scene.
And cameras eavesdropped as set designer Ken Adam explained his concept for the film's centerpiece to director Lewis Gilbert.
My feeling is as the submarine goes in...
Into darkness.
Yeah, yeah. Into darkness, yeah. And, you know, with the high fin and the conning tower, I think that'll give you a very good...
Yeah, because I discussed with Claude yesterday, actually, that I thought the best way of showing the set was to suddenly switch on all the lights.
Yeah.
The lights come on, and a submarine rises up out of the water.
A 380-foot-long set is a life-size mock-up of the interior of a 600,000-ton supertanker, containing three submarines floating in 1.2 million gallons of water. As if that wasn't enough to keep the 400 guests wondering, girls from the cast stripped off their minks in sub-zero temperatures, all in the name of publicity. The film is costing over £6 million, and this set alone, £1 million. Appropriately, 007 himself arrived in futuristic style. And then, with his adversary, a female Russian super spy, accompanied the ex-prime minister around the world's largest film stage.
Believing they had a hit on their hands, United Artists spent a record $4.4 million on worldwide publicity. And who better to front it than the man himself?
Nationwide, 1977.
My name's Bond, James Bond, and I'm licensed to kill. There's a royal premiere tonight. It's the latest Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. It has women, action, and me. So have you tonight on Nationwide at 6:20. I'm Roger Moore, so watch The Spy Who Loved Me, and you'll love James Bond. It still works on the third take.
Roger, you do spoof the part a bit, don't you? You think it's funny in a way.
Well, of course. The whole thing is that you must not laugh at it. You must let the audience know that they're invited to laugh with you. And so it's all a spoof. It's fun.
The film's most topical gag came in the form of its larger-than-life villain, Jaws. Bond's most formidable foe since Oddjob.
This marvellous man who plays Jaws, he's 7'2". When he was grappling with you in the railway carriage, what was it like? Was he built like a...
It was hell. He is a very gentle man and very nice, but he's very heavy. And when he had me squashed up against that wall, there were like 20 stone pushing this bone here right through to the back.
Yeah.
Bond's highly choreographed confrontations with Jaws were a large part of the film's phenomenal success.
Bond grabs a lamp as they grapple. He holds it to Jaws' metal teeth, electrocuting him. Then he hits him with a chair and kicks him through the train window. Now film 79.
And so popular was this mighty-mouthed adversary that when the production jetted off to Rio de Janeiro for the next movie, they did the unthinkable.
Lewis Gilbert, director of Moonraker.
We've done something in this film that's never been done in any Bond film. We've had to bring him back. And really, that's partly because there's so many people around the world vote in, saying, is he going to come back, you know? And that's, so we had to bow to that kind of thing.
we should stop altogether at one point and be suspended and be looking ahead at where at the other cable car. Out over there.
From high jinks over Rio to laser battles in outer space, Moonraker was quite simply out of this world. But James Bond would come hurtling back to Earth for an unusually close encounter.
It is being said at the moment that another rival James Bond film is going to be set up with your own original James Bond, Sean Connery, playing the part. Does that worry you at all?
Well, that's a legal thing. I'm not going to get into any legal discussions about it.
But would it worry you if such a film were to
be made?
Nothing
worries me if I'm making a good film.
Broccoli may have brushed off the question, but Barry Norman was onto something. And by the summer of 1983, look who was back.
38. Ready?
Connery was in production on the aptly titled Never Say Never Again, a remake of Thunderball, the film rights of which resided with an independent producer.
It seemed quite a good idea after all these years. And the moment I said, yeah, OK, I'll do it, there was a terrific furore.
With Roger Moore then in production on Octopussy, the press looked to stoke up a bitter rivalry. But the 00s were having none of it.
I made it quite clear at the outset that I was not in any way going to get involved in any silly race in terms of rivalry or whatever. As you well know, I've known Roger 20 years or so. And I did say to him, you know, they're going to try and play a sort of hype business, but you shouldn't really pay any attention to it. And we didn't.
However, the BBC hardly remained impartial themselves.
Good evening from the Warner Theatre in Leicester Square, where the crowds are already beginning to gather because James Bond is back. The real James Bond. At least the real one in many people's eyes. Not Roger Moore, the pretender who has usurped the role for the last 12 years, but the original Sean Connery. Welcome back, James, as it were. I must put it to you, this is rather unfair, but I was looking up the 00 rule book, and it turns out that it's automatic retirement at 45. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, I've got 2 years yet.
By the mid-1980s, James Bond had become something of a middle-aged man's fantasy.
Do you hear them muttering? Do you listen out for what people are saying about the movie, or about you specifically?
Oh, it's old Moore again, they say. Oh, Rog.
Roger Moore seemed to be a long way from leaping over crocodiles. Approaching 60, he now jogged about in a suede blouson.
What was it you were just running away from then?
A bad cigar.
38.
And in rather less exotic locations.
We're in the Amberley Chalkpits Museum in Sussex. It's a gold mine, presumably in San Francisco or near San Francisco. And the mines are about to be blown up to flood Silicon Valley.
38.
Because Zarin, Christopher Walken, is going to take over the world production of microchips.
But when the action itself involves the chief villain, a peroxide Walken, escaping at 5 miles per hour in a minecart, a damsel in little distress,
James!
And a blow-up Grace Jones, the writing seemed to be on the wall. A View to a Kill was to be Roger Moore's farewell to the character he had inhabited since 1973. Having led the field, Bond was now in danger of being eclipsed by a new breed of imitator, the all-American action hero. But you can't keep a good man down.
A new man is about to take on the villains who want to cause mischief around the world. We have a new James Bond. After Connery, Lazenby and Moore, now it's Dalton, Timothy Dalton. A Welsh actor who's more used to playing Shakespeare than secret agent.
A skydiving scene. And it was to be a stagey entrance. In the pre-title for The Living Daylights, not one but three 00 agents are presented to us in a training exercise on the Rock of Gibraltar. But it's only when one of them falls to his death that we first catch sight of a new, hard-edged James Bond, both brooding and Byronic. And inevitably, the comparison game began.
Well, now, how will the new James Bond differ from his various predecessors?
I don't make those comparisons. I have a script called The Living Daylights, a character called James Bond, and
I do my best to make it as well as I can. I can't think of copying or being different to. I try to be original.
I studied the books and tried to bring that Bond into this film.
From your comrades in the Soviet Union.
Barry Norman talking to Timothy Dalton on Film 87.
How much of the stunt work does Timothy Dalton do himself?
This is the sort of question that you should not be asking. Cinema is magic. When people pay their money and go and sit inside a cinema, they must believe. And programs like this, I mean, betray all our tricks. You wouldn't expect a conjurer or a magician to give his tricks away. Now, the truth of the matter is that I do as much action as I can.
That is, until it came to the bedroom action, which would see Dalton's Bond forgo the usual casual liaisons for a Hitchcockian love story.
Take me on the wheel.
I think this film, it's not just an action-adventure film. It's the first time you've seen what could be called a romantic mystery thriller. There's an honest and good relationship with the leading lady.
However, the press were keen to make Bond's monogamy more topical than the producers had perhaps intended, with headlines that this was a safe sex Bond for the AIDS era. But a more likely explanation is that it was all part of Dalton's aim to return to Ian Fleming's Bond, who was far from being the kind of Casanova that everyone imagined.
He has one girl per book, approximately, and that's one a year. I think that's he's a bachelor. And he moves around the world pretty rapidly, and I didn't see any great harm in that myself.
Fleming's Bond was a man who often was extremely vulnerable. You read passage after passage after passage throughout the books where his insides were taut and wrenching with nerves, where, you know, he'd have to have a drink or a pill just to stay calm in order to do the job he had to do.
Coming hard on the heels of Roger Moore's long and light-hearted reign, the world was not quite ready for Dalton's taut and unsmiling secret agent. His second outing, License to Kill, still rated the most violent Bond film to date, would be his last. And by the early 1990s, the franchise was in jeopardy, plagued by a series of legal disputes over copyright. This was a time of dramatic political shifts in Europe, and 007, the quintessential Cold War hero, suddenly seemed obsolete. It was to be the longest hiatus in Bond's film history. But in 1994, he was back.
Pierce Brosnan, the new Bond unveiled a few minutes ago, made his name as an action man in the US TV series Remington Steele. Now he has to prove the Bond formula and the character can still work in the 90s.
It was a shaky start, though, as shown when the BBC caught Brosnan off guard.
Well, now I'm joined from central London by the new 007, Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan, congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you going to be bringing anything new to this role?
Myself, I'm new.
Yes, but what's going to be different?
Well, I think we have a... with the story outline we've got now, we have...
He hadn't a clue. But by the time cameras caught up with him on location, he was the model Bond.
The main task at hand is really getting this film and telling the story. And we are doing that. We have a wonderful director in Martin Campbell, who's very hungry for this, and likewise myself, in wanting to get it right.
For a new Bond and a new director, it was a daunting task.
And what we're filming today is the streets of St. Petersburg. We built the set here at Leeton, as you can see. I've got an 18-week shoot. I've got four units at any one time. Right, you can hear them all yelling and screaming around the corner. Probably want me to get round there.
On the day we turned up on set, Brosnan was concerned that we weren't seeing Bond in quite the right light.
I'm going to be doing action tomorrow. I will be more Bond tomorrow, I promise you, Barry. I'm sorry, it's a bit boring today, and it's... This is all she wrote, you know? Tomorrow I have the gun, and I have the girl.
And Brosnan was true to his word.
And action!
The next day, he swapped his Russian runaround for something a bit bigger, in a scene that took 6 weeks to film.
He's in a tank topped by a statue of a winged horse, which smashes into a building, then falls onto the pursuing police vehicles. In the tank, Bond comes to a sudden stop, and police cars and winged horse slam into the back of him. He peers out of the tank, then straightens his tie and drives off. Now a black and white still of Brosnan in a sports car.
As well as witty action scenes, director Martin Campbell, together with his screenwriters, set about bringing back the familiar, such as Bond's old Aston Martin DB5. But there was nothing predictable about their recasting of M, and in handing her the line that had been coming to Bond for more than 30 years.
I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War, whose boyish charms, though wasted on me, obviously appeal to that young woman I sent out to evaluate you.
Point taken.
Stella Rimington, the director general of MI5 at the time, was convinced that they had merged fact and fiction in casting Judi Dench.
I can't imagine that had my appointment not been publicly announced, the producers of the James Bond film would ever have thought of making M a woman. I was quite taken aback, actually, because she did look quite like I looked in those days. I had a jacket without a collar and a sort of three-quarter length, which is exactly what she was wearing.
But despite their similarities, the true inspiration for a female M was revealed on Pebble Mill by no less than the former Miss Moneypenny herself.
Cubby Broccoli called me to say that they wouldn't be using me, and I said, well, that's all right, because I want to play M. So all those years ago, I had given them the idea that there would be a tremendous element of surprise if the new Bond walked into M's office, the chair swiveled around, and there was Moneypenny, and she never called him James again because she was the boss.
Did I see the other day that the Judi Dench has been cast in that part?
Yes, and I feel rather betrayed, actually.
I bet you do.
Yes.
So
because it should have been me. And even if, I mean, she's a lovely actress, but it just should have been me.
Across four films, Pierce Brosnan successfully reinvigorated the franchise and turned Bond once again into a major box office attraction.
A photo shoot for the stars of the Bond film.
But with 2002's Die Another Day, they stretched believability beyond the limit. James Bond was now at the mercy of CGI, be it an invisible car or even kite surfing a tsunami.
The last 7 years have gone very quickly. You know, there's a certain, obviously, maturity. And just as you're getting the hang of it, they're talking about someone else coming along. Yes. Show business. It's always been like this. I remember when Connery stepped down, it was like, who's going to be the next guy? So it's the big circus, and the family, the Broccoli family, have always done it really well.
Sure enough, 2 years later, with talk of his fifth Bond film, Brosnan learned that he would no longer be the main attraction. The circus was moving on, and its ringmasters were now scouting for a new and younger man to top the bill.
We have decided after the last film to go back to a more realistic Bond, sort of go back to basics, go back to the classic Bond, and we hope that that's something the audience will appreciate. I think people are looking for something a little less frivolous today. The world's changed a lot, and Bond always changes with the world.
But the world was in for a shock.
Finally, the name's Craig, Daniel Craig. After months of speculation, the coveted job of being the next 007 has been landed by the 37-year-old English actor. But after four decades of tall, dark and handsome, are we ready for the first blonde Bond?
I want to make the best film we can, the most entertaining film we can. And it's not a question of redefining, but it's a question of taking it somewhere, maybe where it's never gone before.
Craig had noble intentions, but for the man with the golden hair, the backlash would be vindictive. Websites were set up saying he was too ugly, too scrawny, too blonde. But any doubts the world had disappeared within minutes of Casino Royale's first major action set piece. And Jonathan Ross was on hand to talk to the principal players on location in the Bahamas.
How's it working out with the crazy Frenchman? You've got this Frenchman who jumps off buildings for fun, I believe.
Yeah, he's got quite a big part at the beginning of the movie. He's, I think, the world's best free runner, so we're including him in the action sequence right at the beginning of the at the movie. And it's tough. It's a very tough sequence.
So I have to climb on the platform, and after I climb on the girder on the top, and on top I have to jump to the crane, and to the crane I have a fight with Bond.
You know, we're not relying on a lot of CGI for this. I will be doing stuff, and some of it will be me and some of it won't be me, for obvious reasons.
But can I stop you? Are you going to be doing the free running? Because I know there's that character earlier.
I've done some of it, yeah.
How's that?
Good.
Terrifying?
No, it's yeah, you know what? I've had to sort of knuckle down and get over a few things. I'm kind of approaching every day as it comes, really, and I get on set and I'm suddenly 200 feet up in the air, and I go, OK, well, you signed up.
As well as being truthful to the action scenes, Craig was keen to be faithful to the spirit of the book and to show the raw vulnerability of 007.
He's not infallible. I just wanted to sort of see him make a few mistakes, because then I think the drama of it is sort of better when he gets it right. I want to make the audience sort of go, oh, my God, it's all going to go wrong. Believe that it's going to go wrong, and then when it goes right, it's much more exciting.
And it's his tangled relationship with the enigmatic Vesper Lynd that causes Bond to bare his soul.
My character is not like a classic Bond girl. She's more like a character from the 40s movies, you know, quite dark, very complex, many layers. You know, she's an equal match to Bond. She's, you know, very mysterious. And the relationship that they have is very unusual. And it's a love story.
It's like there's blood on my hands. It's not coming off.
Yeah, I see.
This was a romance not seen since the days of Dalton and Lazenby. But for all the new intensity in Craig's interpretation of the character, there was still one Bond convention that was inescapable.
Have you said the line
I
yet?
I have, yeah.
You have? Was it okay?
Yeah.
How many takes?
We did a few, and it wasn't much of that. We were outside, there was a lot of wind. Yeah.
That must have been quite nice, anyway, though.
It was nice to get it out of the way.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it. I didn't think about it until the moment, and we did it. You know, it's at a very key moment in the movie as well, which is hopefully going to, you know, it's going to hit home.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Craig high-fives Jonathan Ross.
The resounding success of Daniel Craig's 007 and of James Bond as a British cultural icon was celebrated in 2012 as part of the London Olympics opening ceremony.
But James, I need you.
So does England.
In a sequence filmed in secret, the world's most famous spy, having given 50 years of dedicated service to his country,
are the things I do for England.
With his own brand of unbending patriotism.
What do I do to blow up the room? Whistle, God save the Queen.
And loyalty to his monarch.
I'm having it patched directly to Buckingham Palace.
Well, I'm sure Her Majesty will be fascinated.
The back of the Queen sitting at her bureau.
James Bond was finally granted an audience with the Queen.
Good evening, Mr. Bond.